Okay, so think about the last thing you actually picked up or used, maybe groceries for dinner tonight, or even just an app you downloaded.
Yeah.
Did you ever stop to think beyond just, do I need this or is this good? What kind of economic thing it actually is?
Probably not something most people consider day to day.
Right, it sounds a bit academic, maybe, but we deal with really different types of goods all the time, and knowing the difference actually sheds light on, why things are priced the way they are or why governments get involved sometimes.
Absolutely, it's not just jargon.
So that's our mission for this deep dive, to really unpack these categories: free goods, private, public, merit, and demerit goods. We're digging into the economic definitions to get some clarity.
Yeah, maybe find a few surprises along the way. It really does give you a different lens to view the world.
Exactly. We're basing this on those core economic classifications. Ready to jump in?
Let's do it. Okay, so maybe start with free goods.
Sounds good. The name is a bit misleading, isn't it? Not just free, as in zero cost.
Right. Not necessarily. Economically speaking, free goods are things that are just, well, abundant in nature. Think about the air we breathe, assuming you're just out in the open.
Or sunlight.
Or sunlight, exactly.
Yeah.
Things that are just there.
So the key ideas are abundance, basically no opportunity cost, because nobody used resources to make the air.
No human effort involved.
And crucially, me breathing the air doesn't stop you from breathing it too. Like rainwater out in the countryside might be another one.
Perfect example. They're non-rivalrous and non-excludable, usually.
Yeah.
And because they aren't scarce in the economic sense and aren't really part of market transactions, they don't usually feature in economic decision making.
They're just a given. Until they're not perhaps like clean air in a polluted city, but that's maybe a different angle.
That complicates things, yeah. But in their pure form, that's the idea. Zero price, no opportunity cost.
Got it. Okay, so that's nature's freebies. What about the stuff we actually, buy and sell? Private goods, these feel more familiar.
Definitely. These are what we mostly interact with as consumers. The defining features here are rivalry and excludability.
Right, rivalry means if I eat that slice of pizza, you can't eat the same slice. It's gone.
Exactly. Consumption by one person prevents consumption by another. And excludability.
That means you can stop someone from getting it if they don't pay. Like needing a ticket to get into the cinema, no pay, no entry.
Precisely.
Yep.
These goods always require resources to make them, you know, labor, materials, all that stuff.
Which means there's an opportunity cost, right? Those resources could have been used for something else.
Always. So examples are everywhere. The bottled water you buy, your phone, clothes, food.
Pretty much anything in a shop. And this rivalry and excludability, that's sort of the engine for markets, isn't it? Incentivizes companies to make things people want.
It does. Because they can charge for it and benefit directly. The price system usually works quite well to allocate these goods in a free market.
Though, of course, access isn't always equal because, well, income differences.
That's the other side of the coin, yes. Access depends on ability to pay.
Okay, so private goods, rivalrous, excludable. Now, what about the flip side, public goods. This is where it gets interesting, especially thinking about the government's role.
Yeah, this is where the market often doesn't quite work on its own. Public goods are defined by being non-excludable and non-rivalrous.
Okay, non-excludable, meaning it's basically impossible or just way too expensive to stop anyone from benefiting once the good is provided.
Exactly. Think about national defense. How could you possibly exclude someone within the country from being protected, even if they didn't pay taxes
He
for it?
really couldn't. Okay. And non-rivalrous, like free goods again.
Yes, meaning one person using it doesn't reduce the amount available for others. The classic example is a lighthouse.
Ah, right. One ship seeing the light doesn't make the light dimmer for the next ship.
Correct. Street lighting is another common one. Public parks, too, generally. The parks can get a bit tricky.
We'll probably come back to that. But this non-excludability thing, it leads to a problem, doesn't it? The free rider problem.
That's the core issue, yes.
Yeah.
If you can benefit from something without paying for it, because you can't be excluded, what's the incentive to pay voluntarily?
Not much, I guess. You just wait for others to pay and enjoy the ride.
Precisely. And if everyone thinks like that, or enough people do, then the good might not get provided at all by private companies looking to make a profit. There's just no viable business model.
Which is why governments usually step in and provide these things, funding them through compulsory taxes.
That's the typical solution, yeah, to overcome that market failure.
You mentioned parks getting tricky, and the source talks about quasi-public goods. What's that about?
Ah, right. These are sort of in between. They have some characteristics of public goods, but not all. Maybe they're non-rivalrous up to a point, or maybe they somewhat excludable.
Like a toll road. You can definitely exclude people who don't pay the toll.
Exactly. So it's excludable. Or a park, it's non-rivalrous when it's empty. But it gets really, really crowded. One more person does kind of reduce the enjoyment for others. It becomes congested.
So it becomes partially rivalrous then.
Sort of, yeah. Or think of a private beach, clearly excludable. These aren't pure public goods, but they share some features. It shows these categories can be a bit fuzzy at the edges.
But the main takeaway for pure public goods is non-excludable, non-rivalrous, leading to the free rider issue, and often needing government provision.
That's the key logic, yes.
All right. Let's shift again. Merit goods. This sounds, well, meritorious, like something good.
That's the idea. Merit goods are things that are thought to be beneficial for people, but which tend to be underconsumed if left purely to the free market.
Underconsumed? Why?
Primarily because of imperfect information. People might not fully understand or appreciate the long-term benefits these goods provide, either to themselves or to society more broadly.
Ah, okay. So it's not just about personal preference. It's about maybe not having the full picture.
Exactly. And these goods often generate positive externalities.
Meaning benefits for people who aren't directly involved in consuming the good.
Yes. Spillover benefits for society. Think about education.
Okay, yeah. Education obviously benefits the student, but a more educated population benefits everyone, right? Through innovation, economic growth.
Precisely. Vaccinations are another classic example.
Yeah.
They protect the individual, but they also contribute to herd immunity, protecting vulnerable people in the community.
Right. Other examples might be, what, health services? Public transport, maybe?
Those are often considered merit goods, yes.
Yeah, so.
So why the underconsumption? Well, like we said, imperfect information is a big one. It's hard to perfectly judge the future payoff of getting a degree, for instance.
Or the exact risk of not getting vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. There's also the short-term versus long-term thing. The cost, tuition fees, the effort of studying, maybe the minor inconvenience of getting a jab or immediate. The benefits often feel distant or uncertain.
Yeah, I can see that. And then those positive externalities we mentioned, individuals, don't usually factor in the benefit to society when making their personal consumption choices.
Exactly. You get vaccinated primarily for yourself, not usually thinking I'm contributing to herd immunity.
So because people might underconsume these beneficial things, what happens? Does government get involved again?
Often, yes. Governments might provide subsidies to lower the price, like subsidized university fees or free vaccinations.
Or even make them free at the point of use, like some health care.
Right. Or they might mandate consumption, compulsory education up to a certain age is a prime example.
Something most of us have direct experience with.
Indeed. And public information campaigns, too, trying to persuade people about the benefits of, say, exercise or quitting smoking, which could arguably be framed as promoting merit consumption.
The goal being to push consumption up towards what's considered a socially optimal level, taking into account those wider benefits.
That's the economic argument, yes. To correct for the market failure caused by imperfect information and positive externalities.
Okay, interesting. Now, if merit goods are underconsumed, I'm guessing demerit goods are the opposite.
You got it. Demerit goods are things that tend to be overconsumed in a free market.
Overconsumed relative to what's considered socially desirable, I assume.
Exactly. And again, imperfect information is often a key reason. Consumers might underestimate or simply ignore the harmful effects of these goods on themselves.
And like merit goods have positive externalities, these probably have negative ones.
Yes, negative externalities are very common here. These are costs imposed on third parties, on society, who aren't directly involved in consuming the good.
Okay, so what kind of things are we talking about? The obvious ones.
The usual suspects, generally. Tobacco, excessive alcohol consumption, maybe junk food, illicit drugs.
Right. And the imperfect information aspect? People might not fully grasp the long-term health risks.
Or they might be influenced by advertising or peer pressure, or simply underestimate the risks of addiction. Addiction itself is a huge factor, actually.
Yeah, that seems critical. Even if someone knows the risks, addiction can override rational decision-making, can't it?
Absolutely. Habit formation plays a massive role. Consumption continues even when the harms are understood, which is a really difficult aspect.
And the negative externalities, what are the costs to society?
Well, think about passive smoking harming others, or the consequences of drunk driving accidents. increased healthcare costs for treating smoking-related diseases or alcohol-related liver problems fall partly on the public purse.
Reduced productivity at work.
Yeah.
Costs of policing drug-related crime. It adds up.
It really does. The source points to significant burdens on healthcare, lower workforce productivity, and increased government spending on regulation, enforcement, rehabilitation.
Yeah.
All linked to the overconsumption of these goods.
So if the market leads to too much consumption, what's the typical government response here? Trying to reduce it, presumably?
Yes. The goal is usually to curb consumption. A very common tool is indirect taxes, often nicknamed sin taxes.
Like the taxes on cigarettes and alcohol, making them more expensive.
Exactly. The idea is that the higher price will deter some consumption. We also see advertising restrictions or outright bans.
Like the bans on tobacco advertising.
Mm-hmm. Public health campaigns warning about the dangers. Age restrictions on sales. Limits on where and when things like alcohol can be sold.
So trying to counteract the imperfect information and account for those negative spillover costs, pushing consumption down towards a more socially efficient level.
That's the rationale, yes. Trying to align the private cost with the broader social cost.
This really ties merit and demerit goods together, doesn't it? Both seem to be about market failure driven by information failure.
That's a great summary. When consumers don't have or don't act on full and accurate information, the market outcome might not be optimal, either too little consumption of good things or too much of harmful things.
It's about making choices without seeing the full picture, or maybe being unable to act on it even if you do see it, like with addiction.
Right. And the source also briefly mentions related concepts like moral hazard.
Where having protection makes you take more risks, like maybe driving less carefully if you have really comprehensive insurance.
Kind of, yeah. Or maybe someone who smokes is less inclined to quit if they know their healthcare costs are covered. And adverse selection.
That's where one side knows more than the other. Like the example of someone with a hidden health issue buying lots of life insurance because they know they're high risk, but the insurer doesn't.
Exactly. These are all ways information imbalances can distort markets and potentially justify some kind of intervention, whether it's regulation or direct provision.
So wrapping this up, understanding these categories, free, private, public, merit, demerit. It's not just for economists then.
Not at all. It's a really practical toolkit for thinking about the world. It helps explain why some things work well through markets and others. Well, others need a different approach.
It highlights where markets might fail, especially with public goods or when there are big spillover effects, positive or negative, and where information isn't perfect.
Absolutely. It gives context to government policies, from funding national parks to taxing cigarettes or subsidizing education. It's about resource allocation and social welfare.
So maybe a final thought for you listening. Next time you see a news story about a government policy, could be a new health campaign, a tax change, funding for infrastructure, try to think about the good or service involved.
Yeah, ask yourself, how would I classify this? Is it public? Private? Does it seem like a merit or demerit good?
And does thinking about it that way help make sense of why the government is doing what it's doing? It's actually a pretty powerful way to analyze things we see every day.